So when you look at Ruth, when you look at Shasta, even Trinity Lake to a certain extent, and it their levels, their current levels, what do you see? Do you see signs of drought? When you see the snowpack, do you see signs of drought? Or is this more of a focus on the southern part of the state?
Well, the message we've been giving is we have a full reservoir. It's been full since December 21st. If there's no place else to put water, how can you say there's a drought? And that's the case in the northern part of the Sacramento Valley. You've got Shasta, which is 109% of average today. You've got Lake Oroville at 113 and Folsom also at 110. So we've seen those reservoirs have had to release water so that they can have enough room for the snowpack when it does melt. And so all of those reservoirs will fill, and they could be full today if they didn't have to release water for flood control. So those are the main reservoirs that supply agencies throughout California, especially the urban agencies. Lake Oroville is the reservoir for the State Water Project, and that's where a large amount of water that goes to Southern California comes from. So when you hear stories about, well, we don't have an end to the drought because it's been dry in Southern California, sure, it's been dry in Southern California, but they get their water from Lake Oroville.
So yesterday there was a comment from, I think it was a congressman from the San Luis Obispo area, lamenting the fact of how many million acre feet had been released and flowed in. I think you're shaking your head, so you must be familiar with it. Is he accurate in that? Is this now not an issue of liquid? Is this more of an issue of we don't have the infrastructure to capture?
If you want to say that the Governor's Tunnels Project is the infrastructure that could help us capture that, yes, it's a matter of not having that in place. What we've seen, if you've been following the news about the Delta Smelt, is that they haven't been able to find any in their surveys that they've done over the past year. And what that translates into is that there are limits on the amount of Delta Smelt that can be trapped at the state's pumps and at the federal pumps in the Delta. And those limits depend upon how many smelt they find when they do these surveys. So this year, that number is very low. So they have a very small margin of error whenever they're running the pumps, so that if they capture one or two or three smelt, then that affects how much they can continue to pump. So that's what we're seeing.
Now, when you say capture, you mean grind?
Well,
you
not,
caught
not
into the
actually.
Engines or?
Screens that they have down at the pumps, the state pumps and the federal pumps. And at the state pumps, they actually end up diverting the fish into a tank. And
so it's like a collection tank.
Yeah,
of
it's
some
a collection
sort.
Fish. They call it, that's it. It's the fish collection facility.
Gee, they named something normal?
They did. Oh. Yes. They do collect the fish, they put them in tanker trucks, and they take them back to the Delta. And they put them in where they're not likely to. Now, some of them die on the way, and for the purposes of the fisheries agencies, they consider them all dead anyway, even though they end up coming back to the Delta. So there's one question that you could pose is, if we do actually salvage these fish before they end up going into the pumps, then why don't you get credit for that?
Well, and is the smelt a protected species?
Oh, yeah. It's
it's one of those that could be a trigger if they're not there or if there are too many getting caught?
Yes. Well, that's the situation that they're facing, is that they monitor the fish that come into the facility, into the fish collection facility, and any time they capture smelt, they're considered dead. And so that counts against the total limit of how many smelt they can kill every year. And so that's the problem this year, is that the number of smelt that have been captured has been inching up, and there's a total limit. And when they reach that total limit, that's when you have to either shut down the system or do a new biological opinion. Anyway, everything goes into regulatory overdrive at that point.
So if the systems are catching more fish, wouldn't it make sense that there are more fish?
No, the number of fish is dependent upon how many they find in the trawling surveys.
So completely independent? These are just rogue fish that
get out
or that aren't counted? I mean, you would think that it just numbers, you know, if there was more, there'd be more caught. And if there were less, there'd be less caught.
Well, the total limit that you can catch at the pumps is dependent upon what the population is that year. So if it's a large population, you have more flexibility. You have more that you can catch before you have to take any action. This year, they couldn't find any smell.
So they couldn't find any except in these diversion pools.
Right. Yeah. So, and that's the issue. And if you go on the Natural Resources Agency's website, they're actually keeping track of how much they've had to ratchet back the pumping at the Delta because of these fish limits. And so all these major storms that have happened in January and now in March have resulted in a lot of flow down the Sacramento River. And a lot of that is not able to go into the pumps because of the fact that they're limited by the amount of pumping they can do.
And the smelt run this time of the year.
Yeah.
Dandy.
Yeah. So that's why if you read the stories about the regulatory drought, there's plenty of water flowing down the Sacramento River. And if there were a different place that water could be diverted, which is the point of the governor's tunnels project, then they wouldn't be subject to these smelt constraints. And so that's why you've got those numbers on the Natural Resources Agency webpage, which says if we had the pumps linked up to these new intakes in the north part of the Delta, here's how much we would be able to take. But because we're constrained by these smelt numbers, which are really just in the southern part of the Delta, here's how much we're losing.
So how long does it take to build a reservoir?
Oh,
if you had to do Ruth Lake again.
If we had to do Ruth Lake and go through all the regulatory approvals?
The current environment.
Here's the estimate for the money that's in the bond measure that passed in 2014, Proposition 1. There was the $2.7 billion of funding for storage projects. And I think most estimates are that it's going to be 10 to 15 years before that money actually turns into any kind of storage.
So that's not just acquisition of the land. That's for the total project.
Planning, design, permitting, actually building the reservoir.
Is that one or two?
Well, that would be for any project you start. It's at least 10 to 15 years.
And, right, no, I'm saying $2.7 billion. Is that
$2.7 billion?
Is that a project or is that?
I think the expectation is that will be put towards at least a couple of projects. And you may have heard about Sites Reservoir, which is the proposed reservoir in the Sacramento Valley, which would be an off-stream storage reservoir where you could put water when you have high amounts of water, and then you could release it again whenever you need it.
So that would be kind of a different way of flood control?
You could do it for that too, yeah.
That would kind of make sense, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, siphon it off, you know, unless there's a bunch of gunk in it, but you probably still have the filters and all that stuff.
Right. That's one project. Another project is called Temperance Flat. It's down on the San Joaquin River up above Fresno. So those are some options. The way the money is structured, it's only supposed to pay for the environmental enhancement part of these reservoirs. And
not the construction?
Well, the construction costs associated with what the benefits would be to the environment. So if you store water...
And we're not part of the environment.
People...
You and me.
People don't count.
People aren't, no.
For the water that's going to go...
We got all this time. We could run a real nice tangent, but I'm not sure that would make sense. Okay, so with the water that is, what is the definition then, and the snowpack that is, what is the definition that these folks are looking for? Do they want Lake Mead and Mono Lake completely full? At what point do they say, okay, we're not in a drought?
You hear different criteria. At one point they were talking about if the reservoirs are 90% of average. Well, we're pretty close to that statewide. We're well over that for the biggest reservoirs. Then you hear, well, we need 150% of normal for snowpack. That's fine, but
we're... How often does that happen?
Very seldom.
So they're baking into this thing their bureaucratic structure.
I think you can probably
50% more than normal?
Yeah, I mean, that happened in 1997. It didn't happen the last two times that the drought ended, which were in 1979 and 1993. Those years were not even El Nino years, but the reservoirs filled those years, and with no more place to put water, how can you say that we don't have enough water?
Well, I would imagine you would probably need to have a 3-year average at 150% to satisfy some of the folks.
Yeah. Well, you're hearing, okay, we don't know what next year holds in store. That's true every year.
Yeah, that's a fact. That's not a condition.
And we have a drought every year. It stops raining in April and doesn't start again until the fall. So by definition, we are in a drought starting probably tomorrow.
So how do you avoid frustrations? I mean, trying to deal with this kind of circular logic normally results in somebody walking away not happy or really, 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 really mad. I mean, you're being sucked into a vortex.
We have, every water agency in the state has a plan for how they deal with water supply every year, when there's a dry year, when there are two dry years, and so on. And we implement those plans whenever we need to. For Ruth Lake, for example, if it reaches a certain storage level, that's when we invoke this requirement of cutting back. And so if we had that situation, our customers and we are prepared to take action. I think the situation that we had last year was that there was a field where there was no snow, and the governor went and said, okay, we've got to do something.
Yeah, that's where he stood in, what is it, 90% of, or 90 inches or some reference to 90?
Well, today...
When it was done yesterday?
It's 5 feet of snow at that location
today.
Last year, there was none.
Kind of sounds like progress to me.
It sounds to me like it's progress. If you look at the snowpack numbers, we're the Northern Sierra, we're almost 100% of April 1st levels. Statewide, I think we're 87%.
Of historical.
Of average.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's that snow is going to melt. It'll flow down into the reservoirs. The reservoirs will be full, and that water will be available. And so I kind of wonder where there's a drought in the state. Now, you could say that because of the water distribution system and the fact that some of the southern reservoirs have not filled up to their average levels because we haven't been able to move the water down there, that sure. Because of the fish and because of the fact that last year was a dry year, and those reservoirs tend to reflect what the previous year's conditions were because they get filled up during the summertime of any particular year. So I think you could say that Southern California may have to deal with some shortages in different places. But when I was talking to my friends this week, who are the general managers of the water agencies down there, they're saying they're not expecting any shortage of supply.
So the guys that normally need it don't. The guys that didn't have it that much last year do. And we still have got the state saying, game on.
The state water project allocation this year, as of March 1st, is 45% of total. And they don't normally get 100%. It's normally somewhere around 50, 60%. And that was based upon the dry conditions in February. But in January, in March, we saw at our location, for example, that we're now 130% of normal precipitation. And that's because we shot up in March. And that's been true in the Sacramento Valley as well. And so you'll see the numbers when they come out from the state water project allocation in April probably go up from 45%. And so that's the number that Southern California agencies and the Metropolitan Water District, which is the wholesaler for Southern California, look at when they decide on how much water they're going to be able to allocate.
KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:20. We'll be back with more from Paul Hellicker.
What could we do as a community to make Humboldt a better place to work and live? The answer is to make sure our kids are literate, able to plan financially, move forward in their education so they are better prepared to enter our workforce, and become contributing and productive members in our society, community, and economy. How do we do it? Through the Decade of Difference Initiative. Visit decadeofdifference.org and find out how you, as a parent, student, or business owner, can help. It's the Decade of Difference. Be part of it.
Time now is 8:22. We're back to Talk Shop.
Good morning. We're back talking shop this morning with Paul Hellicker, the general manager of the Humboldt Bay Municipal Water District. Paul, looking at the rainfall numbers today, what are we, 30-something, 40-something percent ahead of normal?
That's
in,
right.
In our region. So we're doing okay. I seem to recall that Southern California hadn't seen the bump that we have with precipitation, and that's the one area that's a little bit off, so to speak. Is part of this equation the aquifers and the Colorado River and the places where Southern California draws a lot of its water from? Is that a factor in what the governor's structure or projected structure is for water and drought and all that kind of stuff? Is that a factor in that?
It's interesting. A couple of weeks ago, there was a presentation to the State Water Resources Control Board by Metropolitan Water District. It was on their status report for water situation in California. And they talked about the fact that for the past 10 years, they've been collaborating with their partners on the Colorado River to try to manage water supplies throughout the whole basin, all the way from Utah down to California. And it was an excellent presentation about the responsible work that they do to try to look at where's water available either in California or on the Colorado River. And when they have less water on the Colorado, they can draw on their supplies in California and vice versa. So last year, for example, in 2014, which was even drier, they didn't draw as much on California and they drew more on the Colorado. I think this year they'll probably reverse that. But the point was that they know what the water situation is, not just in California, but across the West through the Colorado River Basin, and they manage accordingly. And they have their partners on the Colorado River that can do so as well. So I think, is that part of the equation? Certainly it is for Southern California. Should that factor into any kind of regulations in California? I would say that the water agencies do a pretty good job of managing not only within their own territory, but all of the connections that they have both in the state and outside of the state.
So it's kind of an intriguing concept for me that they're looking at the state as this one monolithic element. And I know there was a little bit of relief county by county, district by district, but it doesn't seem like there's an awful lot of recognition of that structurally.
Well, last year we had a full reservoir, and we argued that it didn't really make sense for us to be required to cut back as part of this statewide effort because we didn't have a drought in our area. And even if we saved water, there was no way that we could get it to anybody else that might need it.
You've been working on that one for a while.
We've been working on that one. Yeah, and we'd love to be able to do so if we did have a way to do it and could use the infrastructure that we currently have. But the point was the statewide drought didn't actually happen statewide. It happened in certain parts of the state. And now we're seeing that even more this year. The only place in California where it's been dry this year has been Southern California. And they do rely on their local rainfall for some part of their water supply equation, but it's a small piece of the puzzle. And the places where they do get water outside of their region, from Lake Oroville, for example, or the Colorado River, they're not affected by drought.
I think Shakespeare had the Comedy of Errors. I think that is in here somewhere.
Or maybe Much Ado About Nothing?
If there wasn't a dollar sign, it probably would be in nothing, but I don't sense that it's going to be a freebie. Where are our elected state officials on this? Have you been talking to these guys and trying to get them to understand a little bit more about the water situation and what's going on? Because I would imagine you and others within their districts have been chomping on them pretty regularly about this designation. Is there the opportunity for those guys to step up to the bat and at least represent the views?
they have certainly been helpful. Senator McGuire is helping to organize a meeting with some of the state water board members before the April 20th workshop that they're planning to have. And Assemblymember Wood has been talking with us about ways that, the legislature might be helpful. But because the governor did this through an executive order, there's not much that the legislature has been able to do. Now, there is some potential legislation that the State Water Board is thinking about proposing, which will get into the legislative process. And so we want to make sure that if they do propose something, that it makes sense, that it's feasible to implement, and so on. So we're talking with Senator McGuire and Assemblymember Wood about what our views are. One thing that has happened this year is our colleagues up in Del Norte County have become very active, and so they are going to be part of this April 20th workshop. They just adopted a resolution up in the County Board of Supervisors saying we don't have drought, we don't need regulations. Our Board of Supervisors is going to consider a similar resolution on April 5th.
Do they pull out of the Smith?
Crescent City does, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the principal source of supply, and the Smith has flooded a couple of times this year. So.
Stunner, stunner, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Whip a drought on this one.
Exactly.
It, you know, and I don't know, maybe the electeds have got too many things on their plates to monitor something like this. It's kind of an ongoing, but I think this is the kind of thing for those of us that are in the wet end of the state that really makes you scratch your head and wonder what really is it that they're drinking in Sacramento? I mean, how could they be even the whisper of a drought, let alone the defense of a drought?
The legislature does get involved. If you look back at 2009 when the water package went forward in the legislature, that was when we had the 20 by 2020 water reduction requirements. But part of that package also was the bond measure that then got delayed until 2014. And then the Groundwater Management Act, the legislature implemented that. And that's the one that requires that groundwater basins become sustainable by 2040. So they do.
So we're going to lose a third of our population south of Stockton?
I hope not.
I mean, you think about some of these goals that they have, laudable as they might be, but they're really impractical. Yeah, I mean,
we'll see.
In 25 years, other than redefining everything and re-infrastructuring everything, I mean, how are you going to do? Just look at the ag community. How are they going to survive unless they do, you know, and maybe hydroponics is the answer for them. But how are they going to embrace any new technology or get anything in place and cost effective to hit those numbers?
Yeah, I think the groundwater issue has become particularly acute in the past 3 years because of the drought. But oftentimes when we do have a series of wet years, the groundwater levels come back up. And now, on a long-term trend in certain parts of the state, it's been down. And I think that's the part that is going to be affected by the Groundwater Management Act. But in the Sacramento Valley, in our Eel River Basin, in the Smith River Basin, most of the groundwater basins in the state, especially those in urban areas, are managed to the point where there's no long-term depletion going on. Groundwater is a resource that we use as a way to back up our surface water supplies. So in dry years, we use groundwater, and wet years, we use surface water.
So in the areas like LA or major metropolitan areas where there aren't that many access points, you know, with the tarmac and the concrete and the runoff, does that water just disappear out into the ocean rather than getting into the groundwater systems?
Yeah, I think throughout the state, if you look at areas where there is a lot of ground cover.
Or perhaps desert also, you know, where it's so baked it just doesn't get in either.
Yeah, that is one of the issues. And so that's one of the things that they're working on in Southern California. They do have percolation basins. And there was an article recently about the Los Angeles and the San Gabriel Rivers and how they have these inflatable dams in parts of the river so that when they do get runoff from storms, the water will flow down, they'll pump up these dams, and then that'll store the water in these alluvial plains, And then it percolates straight down into the groundwater. So they do have systems down there to collect stormwater, and they're building even more. And that's a, it's an excellent example of how you can use technology to help to restore what the conditions were before we paved everything.
And that's a, there's enough liquid to be able to satisfy that need or that requirement?
I don't know that there's enough to serve all of the customers in Southern California with groundwater from stormwater, but it's a way to use that resource that is available.
KINS, News and Information Times, 8:32. We'll be back after this update from Damien.
What's the shopping show all about?
If you haven't listened to the show before, it's kind of tough to describe.
I guess the easiest first step is to simply go to the Shopping Show website.
TheShoppingShow.net.
And join us this Saturday for the next Shopping Show.
On KINS 106.3 FM.
KURY FM 95.3 and 101.3 in the Illinois Valley.
And KEKA 101.5 and 100.9 in Eureka.
Thanks, Damien. KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:35. We are back talking shop this morning with the general manager of the Humble Bay Municipal Water District, Paul Heliker. Paul, looking at, as best we can, to the drought and the water situation in our part of the coast, do you see, as part of this drought and part of this designation, that they're going to try to get into the ag community and the farmers and regulate the produce? And as I know, over the years, historically, there have been arguments about don't grow rice, don't grow alfalfa, it's too water intensive, we need to do da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Okay, fine. And I suppose, you know, using historical methods, that might have been the case. Do you sense that it's going in that direction, or that it could go off on that kind of a tangent?
I think it'd be pretty hard to argue that the state has the knowledge or expertise to be able to make decisions about what you grow. It sounds sort of like 5-year plans from other parts of the world. I think that what we see in California, it's a marketplace that's completely integrated into the global economy. And on the one hand, you hear people say, well, we really should be putting our water towards the highest value crops. Well, that's what farmers do. It costs a lot to put that water on the field.
It's just a free market.
Yeah.
We're at work, yeah.
Yeah, okay. And you can see with the progression of crops that are grown in California, as land prices have increased, as input prices have increased, you've seen a transition from what had been a large crop in California, cotton or tomatoes. Those now don't exist in large parts of California. You've got tree crops. You've got almonds, which are a very productive crop, a very valuable crop. Strawberries, too. If you look at the history of how agricultural land was used in Monterey County, for example.
Yeah, Santa Cruz, yeah, Gilroy area. Yeah.
Right. They used to grow a lot of lettuce. Well, they still do, but now more of that land has been converted into strawberries. And strawberries are a very valuable crop. They produce more dollars per acre than lettuce does. And so that seems to be what the mantra is from people who've been advocating that we use water more efficiently. So the agricultural community has responded. They still use a large amount of water in California because that is one of the major inputs. We do have a drought every year that we have to deal with, and you can't grow crops without water. So will the long-term trend be that state agencies exert more regulatory authority? I doubt it. I hope not. I think what you've seen with this current millennial drought that people keep talking about is that...
It's the millennials' fault?
It's the millennials' fault.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah. that the governor decided that what he wanted to regulate was lawns.
Yeah, he got into that one pretty hard, didn't he?
Yeah, it's pretty much what the regulations...
I didn't think the wine industry would be on his target.
No. No, yeah, he hasn't been lobbying about we got to cut back on the number of grapes that we grow.
Right. There was a presentation that John Sapper and Gary Eagles made what was it, a couple weeks ago now? Yeah, a couple weeks ago, about hydroponics, and that the Office of Ed is going to have one of the vocational career programs is going to be hydroponics. And John had said an interesting statistic to me, and I set this up for the follow-up question. He said that it's 8 times more efficient to grow by hydroponic than it is in the dirt, and that in a warehouse 36 by 90, they could have the equivalent of, if they chose to go all with lettuce heads, 2,000 heads of lettuce coming to maturation each week. Okay. Question I've got is, does water get tired like soil gets tired?
I don't think so. Water,
nutrients,
for hydroponics, like that? You have to add the nutrients.
Right.
And the plants take those up. And then whatever the process is for recycling that water once it passes through the plant growing zone, probably then cleans the water and brings it around to be able to recycle, be used again.
I didn't take chemistry.
But soil, when you say soil gets tired, I guess there are certain mechanisms for that. You use the nutrients that are in the soil, and you have to replenish those. That's what fertilizer is all about. You want to make sure that the soil has a good ecosystem that can produce a good foundation for plant growth, and that's where you get into what sort of pests do you have, pathogens, do you have worms in the soil that attack the roots of the crops, and so on. So that's why you historically, farmers have rotated crops so that you don't tend to foster that negative environment there for growing broccoli, for example.
Yeah, kind of tough to do if you're in the wine industry, though.
That's
which
true.
Is one of the battles that they've got is working with that.
Yeah.
With the fluoride that the water district has, are there different types of fluoride also?
We don't fluoridate the water.
The cities do that?
Yeah.
I guess your customers, I think that's a vernacular that's used.
The municipal customers, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Are there different types of fluoride?
Sure, there are different types of fluoride, but they all end up producing the fluoride ion, and that's what provides benefit for teeth. And it's interesting, the debate about fluoridation rages in different parts of the state. When I ran the water district in Marin County, we did fluoridate, and it was at the behest of the voters. They passed 2 resolutions saying we want fluoride in the water. And I talked to my dentist one time and said, so what do you see? He said, well, I can tell the minute I open somebody's mouth as to whether they drink your water or bottled water, because the number of people that have cavities that drink bottled water is astronomical.
Really? I hadn't even thought about that would be an additive in the bottled water, or wouldn't be.
No, it's not an additive.
Or not contained.
Right.
Probably have to be all over the label, huh?
Yeah, and historically, dental disease was one of the great scourges of humankind, and that's one of the public health success stories that we have in this country, is that no longer do we have massive cavities and rotten teeth and diseased gums, and it's in part because of fluoridation.
So why doesn't the water district fluoridate for everybody? Because I would think if one did it, it'd be more efficient and less costly for everybody.
I think we've had that discussion before, and I think that the cities decided that they wanted to manage it. But I tell you what, before the next time I come back, I'll do some research and I'll give you the full story.
You guys do a fair amount of water treatment, though, also.
We do. We provide all the treatment that the water customers need. So we filter the water, we disinfect the water, and it's ready to go when we deliver it to them.
So what's that process all about? How do you get it to that point? Yeah.
Well, we have this wonderful riverbed that we have galleries underneath at our collector stations at Essex. They're on West End Road on the east end of Arcata. And that riverbed provides the filtration that normally other places have to produce through building treatment plants. So filtration and then disinfection are the standard treatment processes for drinking water. And we provide that with the riverbed filtration. Now in the wintertime, because sometimes we get additional levels of turbidity, solids in the water.
Gunk.
We run it through our treatment facility that we built a few years ago up on the hill above Essex. And so that provides an extra level of filtration. And then we chlorinate it, which kills all the remaining pathogens that might be in it. And so it's pretty safe. It's very safe, I should say. It meets all standards. And we also check for lead and copper in the water as well.
Do you have folks occasionally, regularly, ask about the chlorine and the chloridation process, and is it safe, and how much, and et cetera, et cetera?
Sometimes. I think people generally are pretty satisfied with the water they get here. It's very tasty. It's very healthy.
So there's not a concern, like when the blue algae stuff hits, people are knocking on your door saying, so exactly what are you doing to make the water that we can't, not supposed to swim in, be drinkable?
Right. Well, the algae, fortunately, doesn't make its way through the filtration process. And even if it did in little bits, the chlorination would kill it. And the algae itself is not a problem. It's typically the taste that it creates is the problem that people experience.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's not unhealthy?
If you get it on your skin, the algae can burn you and cause problems.
Okay, because of the nitrogen level.
Yeah.
It's allowing, okay. Huh.
And that's why it's called cyanobacteria, the blue-green algae. Whenever it blooms in the summertime, that's when the health department recommends that you don't go swimming in those areas.
Yeah, another one of the great gifts of modern society. Yeah.
Right. But that's why we filter water, so that all of that material gets taken out.
Are people, when they go on the tours, impressed with the degree of which the water is treated?
Yeah. People, I think, enjoy finding out about how their water comes from the river to them and the processes that we use.
What gets the biggest wow out of them?
I think the view from our control room out over the river.
Up in the cement tower? Oh, that would make sense. When the Mad is a creek, how deep is the water flowing beneath what we can see?
When the Mad is a creek?
Yeah. Yeah, the water run on the surface is really low, and you see pooling instead of a current.
Oh, okay.
How far down is there water that's still moving towards the ocean?
The Mad River and most rivers that have a sandy base and an alluvial basin like that, the surface of the water is really just the top of the whole column of water that exists all the way down to the bedrock. And so our collectors are 70 feet or 90 feet below the top of the riverbed. So even if there isn't water that is covering the top of the riverbed, you still have water throughout that whole alluvial plain. And then it continues to percolate down and flow fairly rapidly into our collector system.
The term bedrock, what is that?
That means where you reach the first really solid foundation. So it goes from the gravel on top, gravel in the sand. So if you walk down to the Mad River and you walk around, you see it's a pretty gravelly, sandy riverbed there. And so that's all been brought down by glaciers and erosion and all of the natural processes that happen. And so that is about 70, 90 feet deep, that gravel bed right there. And then below that, you get to a soil horizon that looks like cracked rocks and big chunks. And then below that, you ultimately reach a place where you have solid rock. And that's what we call bedrock.
And that's where the filters are?
They're above that. They're still in the bottom
part,
in the bottom part of the gravel bed.
Because it just wasn't necessary to go any further?
Well, you don't want to go any further because the water won't flow as well through the bedrock.
Oh, there's just not as much movement.
Yeah. So the water in the gravel bed flows easily, but then there is water in the bedrock layer, but it doesn't flow that quickly. In fact, it doesn't flow much at all.
So it's more of a stagnant pool or just...
It's
just a non-movement.
Like, yeah, it's a very solid base of rock that has water in it that doesn't move very quickly. If you put a well down there, you wouldn't get much flow.
So what's the purest water? At what level?
Oh, the further down you go, the more filtration you get, which is why we put our collectors at the bottom of the gravel bed.
But at bedrock, it's not any more pure, so to speak. The difference between 70 feet and 90 feet
no.
isn't enough to get excited about.
No. And we wouldn't want to put it in the bedrock because you wouldn't get any water flow.
Yeah, you do want water when you...
That's the point.
Yeah, folks want to know more about this kind of stuff. Where can they go to get some of the real rudimentary or fundamental information?
We just revamped our website, as a matter of fact, to try to make it easier for people to find information. And so you can find these charts that we're looking at this morning on our website. We also just created a Facebook page where we're now putting the latest. So when you put this recording up, we will put the link there.
Cool, cool, cool. Thanks for coming by, Paul.
My pleasure.
Yeah. Thanks for that, too.